I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 12th of May. Mondays at 1, all things political. Daniel DeSalvo is our guest this hour, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership, assistant professor of political science at the City College of New York. His work focuses on American political parties, elections, labor unions, state government, and public policy. We'll talk about Benghazi once again. Why are Republicans wanting further investigation into the attack? We'll talk about whether or not the Republican fervor for repealing the Affordable Care Act has waned. What has been described as one of the first cases to rely on the U.S. Supreme Court's McCutcheon decision on May 6th. Federal Judge Rudolph Randa ordered a halt to Wisconsin's John Doe criminal probe into allegedly illegal coordination between political campaigns and the nonprofit groups like Wisconsin Club for Growth. And we'll talk about that as well. And our guest wrote an interesting piece. He does a lot on teachers and unions that appeared in the New York Post. New York City can't afford the teachers' contract, which I thought would be interesting for us to discuss this hour. And I'm certain that you may have some issues that you would like to discuss as well. So, may I give you our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Daniel DeSalvo, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure to be with you.
Let's start with Benghazi. The Speaker of the House, John Boehner, appointed 7 Republicans to a 12-person panel. The Democrats are not very happy about this. They are calling it a witch hunt. Why would the Republicans bring up Benghazi again? What do we not know about Benghazi?
Well, I think their argument is that so far the other 7 prior investigations into the Benghazi matter yielded good information, especially from the Department of Defense, which cooperated fully, but they still haven't gotten the kind of cooperation that they seek from the State Department, which has, in the eyes of Republican staffers and investigators on the Hill, given them a bit of the runaround. So one might hope that they would uncover more of the State Department's thinking, and especially going to the question of whether there was efforts to reframe in the media or massage this message such that it insulated Secretary of State Clinton and the president.
Mm-hmm. The Democrats, some are saying what the Republicans hope to do is get their base to the polls during midterms. Is there any truth in that allegation?
Well, certainly, that's obviously, to the extent that it's an allegation and it's circulating around, by repetition, it can kind of become true. Republicans say that Benghazi is important because it shows that the State Department under Ms. Clinton was not up to speed on what was happening, that it called into question the president's foreign policy as regards to Libya. So there are obviously political overtones to the entire enterprise.
Mm-hmm. And yet, when you look at public opinion polls that show how closely we are following this issue and whether or not we care about it, it doesn't rank very high. It must rank higher to some people who might be potential voters. I mean, it's not an issue that a lot of people, they sort of have forgotten about it.
I completely agree with you. I think the polling evidence shows that most Americans have moved on from this. They're not paying attention. They're not interested in this subject. But to the extent that it can energize and rally a very, say, narrow but intensely concerned slice of the Republican Party base, to the extent that it has that effect, they could say that on the political dimension, beyond the truth or falsity of what happened in the wake of Benghazi, the Republicans could see that as a reason for going forward with yet another investigation.
Mm-hmm. Trey Gowdy, the South Carolina Republican former prosecutor who's going to be leading this committee, said that he would not use the attack to raise money for the Republicans, but he did say Democrats had done the same with tragedies like the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary, and he says, and I quote, "It would be helpful if our colleagues on the other side of the aisle did not have selective amnesia when it comes to what's appropriate to raise money off of and what's not."
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, this is a real internecine battle on Capitol Hill. By calling yet another investigation, the Speaker of the House has partly put the Democratic Party and its leadership on the Hill in a bind. If they don't cooperate, it looks like they have something and appoint the other five members to this committee. It looks like they're stonewalling or that they have something to hide. If, on the other hand, they appoint people, then that gives legitimacy to the enterprise of yet another investigation into Benghazi.
Mm-hmm. Are the Republicans still going to use the problems with the start of the Affordable Care Act and some potential problems with and real problems with Affordable Care Act as a main campaign issue for the midterms, Daniel, and should they?
Well, I think they'll... I think the message has been delivered. Public opinion is, you know, largely on the Republican side in the sense of skepticism about the Affordable Care Act. Democrats, of course, are, for the most part, are not keen on running on their own achievements. So in that respect, I would say that the Republicans are in a bit of a bind to the extent that the kind of signature issue that they've been criticizing and about which the public is also skeptical, Obamacare, the point has in a sense been made, and they can try to continue to make it over and over, but how much more that will rally their supporters is, of course, questionable. So I think that it's a point that will probably continue to be made, but not with the same intensity as it has been in the past.
Mm-hmm. Our first caller wants to talk about Benghazi, so we'll go to phone calls. We'll weave them in and out of this hour. We have a lot of issues to talk about, but here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. Dave in Menominee, Michigan is calling in. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to bring up the difference. Look at the difference we've had between the reaction in 9/11, how the country had come together, and how the Republicans are using this attack where four Americans died. Even though all the attacks in the embassies under Bush, there were probably four or five times as many Americans that died during that time. And I just think, you know, this, of course, is to hammer away and try to keep Hillary from, you know, running for president. And digging for reasons, of course, they've been talking impeachment since day one. And they will for every Democrat, not just any, but just for all Democrats, that will be what we see. And I just wanted to get your guest thoughts on that.
All right. Thanks, Dave. Daniel.
Well, in terms of the larger political motivations of this inquiry, to the extent that it can dredge up things on Ms. Clinton and damage her 2016 presidential prospects should she decide to throw her hat in the ring. One could imagine Republican strategists as seeing a certain benefit in that. To the extent that the investigation calls into question the competence of the president and his team in leading from behind on the Libya invasion, they probably would also seek to score some political points on that front as well.
Thanks, Dave, for the call. We have lines open if you want to join All Things Political. 800-486-8655 is our number. Email is talk@wpr.org. We've started with Benghazi. Obviously, a question to you is, do you feel like you know what happened there? Is it worth another investigation, congressional investigation? Is it politically motivated, or is it an important issue that we need to get the absolute truth? We welcome your thoughts on this. We've been doing years and years on healthcare reform programs on this particular show, and covering the whole New York Times series on the healthcare system and the incredible costs in the healthcare system. Why is it that even though there may be disagreement, to put it mildly, about the Affordable Care Act, why isn't there some kind of congressional investigation and serious consideration given to how to make our health care system more affordable, to make it more efficient? Why do we ignore that, Daniel?
Well, we ignore it because of the existing structure of the system, and changing that system, as we've seen in any direction, is very complicated because it inevitably touches on very powerful and very entrenched existing constituencies. So, you know, the biggest problem at the core of what drives our healthcare costs is our third-party payment mechanism. Which means if you go to the doctor, you know, and the doctor prescribes an extra treatment or test, you're unlikely to think in a cost-conscious way because, well, if the insurance covers it, fine, let's go forward. And the doctor on the other side is unlikely, you know, earns his or her living by prescribing more treatments and tests and charging the insurance companies for them. So on neither side of the health exchange between doctor and patient are cost control incentives in place. But, of course, touching and changing that mechanism from its curious mix of public and private entities that are on the insurance side can be enormously politically controversial.
Mm-hmm. Well, heaven forbid we would do anything that was politically controversial. It's always better to do nothing, right?
Well, it's often easier to duck right. and do nothing, but it's often the case that people are unsure. You know, much of the cost of our health care is often some of these increased costs, you could say, would be justifiable insofar as the United States does a lot more medical and scientific research and is the generator of new treatments, of new drugs, in a way like no one else on the world stage. On the other hand, you know, there's an enormous amount of paperwork and bureaucracy in the healthcare system, and you know, there's been ideas around for years for how to handle these things, but each one of these things has significant and powerful political opponents.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Chris in Georgia. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I just wanted to make a statement about, you know, like the previous caller calling about, you know, the Republicans basically using this. And I just think, you know, it should be mentioned more, you know, from the perspective of, you know, just voters in general that, you know, there's a lot of us out there that are kind of, you know, suspicious of what, you know, what might have happened. And maybe we think, you know, the administration was a little bit irresponsible about the matter. And, you know, I think maybe, I mean, has anybody ever thought maybe the Republicans are doing it, you know, to represent the people who yeah. voted them into office rather than maybe just doing it for, you know, another political propaganda?
You're talking.
I don't think that's talked about enough.
Are you talking about Benghazi, Chris?
Yes.
Yeah. Daniel?
Yeah, I think your caller has a very good point, which is to say that, you know, Republicans could say and have said that this is a real and serious issue, that the remarks of Susan Rice and others in the administration in the immediate aftermath of the Benghazi attack sought, in effect, to, you know, to put it gently, reframe, to put it a little bit more tough. In a more tougher way, basically lied to the American people about what was happening in order to insulate the Secretary of State and the President. And that sort of behavior by high-ranking officials deserves the scrutiny of congressional committees and of the opposition party. Furthermore, on the other question of whether the decision-making leading up to staffing this embassy and its security requirements, so far the prior investigations have revealed that there was nothing more that could have been done by the military. All of its assets were too far away to come in at the last moment and rescue the embassy once it was under attack. But whether the decision-making about staffing and security by setting up this embassy was wisely conducted, again, that's an area where Republicans feel the State Department hasn't been forthcoming enough.
Thanks very much for the call, Chris. We will talk about some other issues. It's on hold right now, although eventually I would imagine the Court of Appeals in Chicago will once again be hearing this case, which has been described as one of the first cases to rely on the U.S. Supreme Court's McCutcheon decision. We'll be talking with our guest. He's not from Wisconsin, but I would imagine that he's pretty familiar with this case, and I would imagine that it will be getting more and more national attention. On May 6, Rudolph Randa ordering a halt to Wisconsin's John Doe criminal probe into allegedly illegal coordination between political campaigns and nonprofit groups like Wisconsin Club for Growth. The order was halted the following day by the Seventh Circuit panel in Chicago, which ruled that he had not certified an earlier appeal from prosecutors as frivolous. On Thursday, then, he ruled the appeal as frivolous and reinstated his order, although not with a message to destroy all of the evidence here. So prosecutors, although we haven't heard yet, are likely to appeal again to the Seventh Circuit. It's a complicated case, but there are it's being played in certain ways. One is that if you are not in favor of this, the judge was usurping his authority here, and that this is something that people on both sides agreed need to be investigated. If you are in favor of his decision, you will be saying that it's a witch hunt against conservatives. So it's a big case. We'll ask Daniel to give us his thoughts about that, and I'm interested in hearing from you on all things political, what you think about what will happen here, how lengthy the process will be. And what it may do to political aspirations of the governor, maybe nothing. Could take a long time for this to weave its way through the courts. Here's our phone number for all things political, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We always like to get messages there. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phone lines are open for you, 800-486-8655. Before we move to the judicial case, which I talked about, let's take one more call from Pat in Richland Center on our aforementioned topic. Hi, Pat.
Well, good afternoon, Kathleen. I used to listen to you, but for the last few years in this time slot, I've been listening to Rush Limbaugh. So that's why I haven't been calling, but... you know, that guy, all those right-wingers, and there's a lot of them out there. I live in Richland Center and can get them 24 hours a day. But the point I want to make is that I'm pretty sure not as many people believe in what Rush is saying and those guys as we're led to believe. You know, every program, he characterizes the Democrats as the enemy. Everybody's kind of the enemy. And also... everything he says appeals, or it is all about greed or fear, even as advertisers. Now, he'll say stuff like, almost every program, Barack Obama, his aim is to bring down American capitalism and turn the United States of America into a third world country. Quote, all right? But my point is, if he is as popular... you know, to make his $500,000 a program, that'd be hard to sit there and lie for 3 hours a day. But anyway, if we have any society that would buy into that type of talk, because that's what the type of talk you'd use to start a civil war, if a majority of a society believes in that and thinks that's the way things should go, we're not going to be seeing a civilized society for a while.
Thank you, Pat, for your comments. Daniel, would you like to respond?
Well, certainly, one could say that, you know, Russia is it's a free market of ideas. Russia has its free speech rights, and one can decide to tune in to Rush or to Kathleen Dunn. And so, media consumers can make their choices. And Rush clearly has a large audience of people who are interested in hearing what he has to say. Is he part of the polarization of media in the country, where people today tend to, you could say, narrowcast? If you're a Republican, you watch Fox News, listen to Rush, and read the New York Post and the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. If you're a liberal, you watch MSNBC and Rachel Maddow, and you read the editorial page with the New York Times, and you have your whole sphere of blogs and radio shows that you listen to. And is that unfortunate for the nation's civil discourse? Sure, but I'm not sure that we should. Individuals are going to have to take action on their own to change that.
Thank you, Pat, very much for your call. Let's move on to what has been talked about, and I believe this may go to the Supreme Court, as and it was mentioned by Judge Rudolph Randa that some of his decisions were based on the U.S. Supreme Court's McCutcheon decision. How closely are national Republicans looking at this Wisconsin John Doe criminal probe and the back and forth with the circuit court and Judge Randa and back to Judge Randa, and whether or not it is the first ruling that is a result of the McCutcheon decision?
Well, I think people are paying close attention to it for a number of reasons. Obviously, Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin is a lightning rod, a potential, should he win re-election, a potential presidential candidate. So there's a lot of interest on that front, and certainly a lot of interest in the investigations and the bumps in the road that Walker has encountered since trying to undertake, big reforms in public employee union policy in Wisconsin. So I think there's interest on, as just as a state matter in Wisconsin, and the nature of this investigative power in Wisconsin, which is quite expansive. On the other side, what you mentioned, campaign finance, is very important on the basis of Citizens United and now this follow-up decision in McCutcheon, and really what's the meaning of outside groups coordinating with the political campaigns? What does that coordination entail? When does it cross the line? That's very important for how campaigns are going to be conducted in the future.
Some have described, those who were in favor of this decision, have described what's been going on in this state, the word witch hunt's being used a lot these days on both sides, that it's a witch hunt, and the witch hunt is against conservative groups, that nobody went after liberal groups in the state of Wisconsin. Why is it that it was a Democratic DA, even though there were Republican judges who signed on to this? Is that a fair description? Do you think that conservatives are under more scrutiny than liberals are when it comes to campaign finance and these kinds of issues?
Well, they are. I think these things, there's an ebb and flow to these things. I think in Wisconsin, since Governor Walker launched his campaign to reform the state's public labor laws, he's been under enormous scrutiny, and many groups inside the state have had significant political means and motive to try to find something that would weaken him. And in that sense, partly the issue is with many of these laws, it's like a special prosecutor at the national level. Once you get one of these investigations going under Wisconsin law, there's so much discretion that can be exercised that no one can really tell where it's going to go, and that insofar as witnesses can be compelled to testify but also not to talk about their testimony, and much of the investigation can be kept secret, it's just an invitation to continue to search around and to potentially find things that were not even really related to what the original purpose of the inquiry was.
Do you imagine, Daniel, that this will eventually go to the U.S. Supreme Court?
I don't know if it will or not. I think it depends on what happens with Judge Randa's ruling. Most judges are sensitive, and they don't like to be overruled by higher courts. So Judge Randa's decision was, and the way it was written, was quite forceful. And in that sense, many people who supported the outcome saw it as a victory for freedom of speech and campaigns. So I couldn't say yet whether it will go to the Supreme Court or not.
Mm-hmm. You probably saw the New York Times piece. We're going to do a show on this later that looked at the partisan nature of the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm wondering if we've entered an era, and if it's good for the country or bad for the country. I was thinking yesterday about where this case landed, and it was in the hands of a judge who many have described as a conservative judge. A couple weeks ago, we had voter ID law that was struck down by a judge who many would consider to be a liberal judge, that you can almost count on what the Supreme Court is going to do based on which Republican president nominated that person, and simultaneously the Democrats are very predictable too, that everybody's predictable, that nobody is independent these days. They're closely aligned with their political affiliation. Do you think that's true?
On certain things, there's something to that, but I think it's easy to overextend that analysis way too far. If you wanted to say all these people are predictable, just look at Chief Justice Roberts in the major Obamacare decision. Not exactly predictable. And it's important to recall, too, that, say, at the level of the Supreme Court, the vast majority of decisions are decisions that are not these close 5-4 decisions on contested subjects. They're 9-0 decisions, or decisions that are 7-2 or 6-3. So really, when people are saying that people are partisan and predictable, it's on a relatively small set of issues on which there's a lot of contention, and views of judges and of American society are quite polarized. So that's things like affirmative action. It's things like campaign finance. It's things having to do with the rights of public employee unions.
Daniel DeSalvo is our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political. We wonder what you think of the decision in the back and forth between courts and then back to U.S. District Judge, Federal Judge Rudolph Randa concerning the John Doe probe. I'm sure many of you listening have thoughts about that. What do you think about it? Do you want this probe to continue, or do you think that it is discriminatory? Would you agree with what the judge said, that based on, he referenced the McCutcheon decision, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, that it sheds a whole new light on this John Doe probe? We welcome your phone calls. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we've been on this theme for a few weeks now as we get, it's pretty close to the midterm elections. Benghazi is an issue that Republicans are investigating once again. Does it play well with people who are likely to go to the polls who are Republican? And what kinds of issues would get Democrats to the polls in midterm elections? What's the role of the Tea Party? We need to talk about that. He was considered more mainstream Republican, won in the primary in North Carolina. That election was closely watched, and he faced challengers, a couple Tea Party challengers, I think. So we can talk about those issues as well. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. We were watching the North Carolina race. A lot of political junkies were. Was it any kind of sign that this midterm season could be a good one for moderate Republicans, Daniel, or not?
Well, I think the Tea Party has suffered some setbacks. Again, they've had trouble fielding candidates that have been able to line up across all of their issues. Now, I think, in fairness to many of the Republicans who've won the primary elections in many places, North Carolina and elsewhere, while they're often described as moderate, they're still quite conservative Republicans, and many conservatives should be happy might be happy with such candidates. So where the Tea Party might have a bigger effect is putting its energies into lower levels of races for state legislative seats, for example. And you might see an uptick in the number of Republican legislative seats, some held by so-called Tea Party members.
Let's go next to Jake in Middleton. Hi, Jake.
Hi.
Hi.
I actually have a question. Might be a little off topic, but it seems like as we progress more, we're running into an age where things are being brought up as far as constitutional reform and stuff go. And it seems like a subject that is kind of referenced, but it never really is given any – any you know, opportunity to kind of grow or really be approached. And I'm wondering if there's any significant changes that can actually occur, or if the system itself is kind of self-sustaining and I don't know, kind of maintains the back and forth that we currently have without any referencing of the underlying fundamentals of it, you know?
Well, let's take that on in terms of something we've talked about recently, and that's a constitutional amendment that would get money out of campaigns. There is a movement afoot here in Wisconsin, slower than perhaps the one in Vermont. There are few places where people are organizing campaigns on that particular issue. Is that a good thing, Daniel?
Well, I think how to address our, in a sense now, jerry-built campaign finance system. There's probably some people that are pushing for constitutional amendments that might allow for greater public financing of campaigns. And that could be an area. Obviously, going back in recent years, there's been other pushes for constitutional amendments to prohibit gay marriage. Many of those have passed at the state, but not at the federal level. And going back, some people to the 90s, some people hope to have a constitutional amendment to introduce term limits for members of the mm-hmm. House and Senate. So there's going to be, American society and politics will continue to generate efforts for these kind of constitutional reforms. Whether they gather sufficient steam remains to be seen. I'd be skeptical about whether any constitutional amendment to dramatically alter our campaign finance system is in the offing anytime soon. That, of course, doesn't mean the changes to our campaign finance system aren't worthwhile.
Thanks so much, Jake, for your call. You know, on some level, you would think that everybody would like to put their money somewhere else, wouldn't you? It's so much money.
Well, it's interesting that you raised that. People often think that, and people in my profession, political scientists, many of them actually ask the opposite question, which is, why is there so little money in politics? If the stakes are so high, why don't very large firms with very deep pockets put more money into U.S. politics? Just to give you a sense of what I mean here, if you take the 2004 election, just because I happen to know the numbers off the top of my head, spending by candidates and parties for all federal offices in 2004 was about $4 billion. And that was actually the same amount spent that same year by just one single company on its advertising to get its message out, which was Walmart. So one might ask, is such large sums, topping over $1 billion, we're likely to see in 2012 and 2016, is for a country, when you're electing people to run the most powerful country in the world with a $14 trillion economy, is that too much to spend on a vigorous civic debate?
Hmm. Except that that doesn't happen. The debate is 30-second commercials run on television, and they're so saturated in sometimes a pretty long period of time before the election, but you don't get a lot of depth from those, do you?
Well, I think actually, again, political scientists maybe sometimes have a contrary view that many political ads actually, especially if you see a lot of them, do contain a fair amount of information, and information that can be gleaned from voters. And the United States has a very long history of very long and very, and generally speaking, aggressive campaign tactics, and that goes all the way back to Jefferson and Madison.
Mm-hmm. I meant to ask you, the issues that you think would be very beneficial for Republicans to hammer away on for the midterm elections, and simultaneously, what would work for the Democrats, Daniel?
Well, let's start with the Democrats and work back to the Republicans. The Democrats are in a tough position. The economy is slowly and haltingly improving, and more people do have health insurance today as a result of Obamacare. So those would be sort of things that they could claim as real achievements, but each of these achievements is a little bit has its problems or comes with its downsides or opens itself up to attacks. So the Democrats, for finding themes, broad themes to campaign on, are a little bit stuck. Republicans, clearly they can campaign on Obamacare. They'll campaign a little bit that the recovery has not been as sharp and steep as it otherwise could have been. They'll campaign on smaller issues, Benghazi, smaller things that of attacking the president. But in some respects, I think, I mean, it's very early to tell. It's only mid-May. But this midterm election seems to be shaping up a little bit differently from past midterms. The midterm elections of the recent past have turned on many national issues. But if you look at American midterm elections going back historically, oftentimes they're about very local concerns, and this election may in some ways return to that tradition.
Republicans going to take the Senate?
Hard to wager a guess. It's going to be very close.
Let's go to John in West Bend next. Hi, John.
Hi, Kathleen. I just was reading a quote from the Appleton Post-Crescent in which Paul S. Ryan, the senior counsel for the Nonpartisan Campaign Legal Center in Washington, D.C., said Judge Randa's ruling, quote, flies in the face of longstanding federal law regulating coordination between campaigns and outside groups. And we also had a case, Judge Wilcox was sued by his challenger, Walt Kelly, along those same lines, and the appeals court, the state court of appeals, agreed with Kelly's position that Wilcox had illegally campaigned with coordinated with outside groups, and he eventually agreed to pay a $60,000 fine. So I guess I'm asking whether Randa's decision is likely to be over in light of those two things. His decision is likely to be overturned quite soon.
What do you think, Daniel?
Well, on the first point, this entire issue of coordinating with campaigns doesn't have exactly the longest history. It really dates to the McCain-Feingold Act of 2002, which was meant to channel part of the issue of any campaign of campaign finance measures, trying to channel money in the campaign and election system, and channeling money is kind of like trying to stop water from going downhill. You can channel the water into different directions. So, in say, up and through the 1990s, the way campaign finance law worked was it channeled a lot of soft money or large donations to the political parties, who then parceled them out to candidates. The McCain-Feingold Act changed that and said that soft money could no longer be given directly to the parties. It could be given to these 501c3 or 501c4 groups, and they could spend the soft money as much as they wanted, because to say that they couldn't spend as much as they wanted would violate their free speech rights, the First Amendment. So that introduced the issue of whether they could then coordinate and to what extent with the existing campaign. And clearly this is an area that's been what exactly constitutes coordination and in what ways. So I think it's not clear that this is something that has such a long history of legal precedent where the rules are exactly clear.
Anything else, John? John's gone. Thank you very much for your call. The other thing, I don't know if this case is complicated, but there have been some reports that you run the risk with this kind of decision, if indeed the circuit court overturns this decision, and you open up a discussion as to whether or not this was a frivolous lawsuit. Those who are doing the lawsuit would say this is not frivolous, and this is the reason why it's not frivolous. All of a sudden, you're exposing, aren't you, what a potential wrongdoing could be, what they're looking at. And we know very little, because the nature of the John Doe is all secretive, so we know very little about that right now.
Right. So it's very hard to predict, I think, you know, how this will turn. Much of this is now down very much into the details of legal technicalities.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it was very much a technicality that determined whether or not they should destroy the evidence already collected in the case. So it's hard to predict exactly where this would go. What's at issue here, if we go all the way back to the beginning and remind ourselves, is whether the Wisconsin Club for Growth, which favors many of the policies that Governor Walker and the state Republican Party favors, whether there was undue coordination with their election campaign. And one can imagine that this is a hard thing to get at between these groups, because clearly one can oftentimes groups just watch what the campaigns are doing and then try to work around that. And that clearly doesn't constitute coordination, but the difference between that and, say, you know, a number of phone calls from people who are in the political world of running campaigns, to what extent do they go beyond some threshold to become, you know, coordinating that would be considered illegally under the law?
We're talking politics this hour of our program. Mondays at 1, we always do what we call All Things Political. And our guest is Daniel DeSalvo. He's senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute's Center for State and Local Leadership. He's an assistant professor of political science at the City College of New York, and he focuses on American political parties, elections, labor unions, state government, and public policy. He wrote an interesting piece, New York City Can't Afford the Teachers Contract. We're moving into a discussion of teaching and segregated schools in the Milwaukee area, hour two of our program, so I thought it would be interesting to hear his thoughts about the teacher's contract in New York and about public education in New York as well. But we welcome your phone calls. You can join us. We've talked about Benghazi this hour. We've looked a little bit at the John Doe investigation and the decisions going back and forth between the federal judge in Milwaukee and the circuit court in Chicago, and whether or not there will be this is going back to the Seventh Court, and whether or not you want it to. What do you think about this? It's an important issue that has, many are saying, national ramifications. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at Kay Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Daniel DeSalvo, our guest. Richard in Madison is our next caller. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Hi.
It seems to me the whole problem with equating free speech with money is that when I speak in a public forum, everybody knows who I am. I have to sign in to speak. When I write a check, I have to sign my name. Why is everybody so afraid to tell us who they are?
Daniel.
Well, I think this is an issue going back. I mean, two points to consider. The caller raised a very, very good and sensitive point, which is the equation of money with speech goes all the way back to a long old Supreme Court precedent in the area of campaign finance law from the 1970s, Buckley versus Valeo. So that's where the origin of this equation exists. The issue of people not identifying themselves, again, stems from a more recent development, which is the ability to donate to the supposed super PACs and not have to identify one's donor list. There's arguments on either side of this equation, but I think in the sake of transparency, if people want to contribute to campaigns and to public discourse, many people think that they should have to identify themselves.
What do you think? Should it all be transparent?
I think that there's a strong case in either direction, but I guess in my own view that there's more transparency in this area is probably for the better.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Richard, very much for the call. Let's go to Pat in Park Falls. Hi, Pat.
Hi, all right. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think your guest is pretty even-handed, but he said something that kind of surprised me. The three wannabe presidential candidates went out to Las Vegas to get the blessing of a person that donated $100 million to the Republican campaigns not too long ago. And they actually went out there and they kind of kissed his ring, and that's fine. I don't care what they do. But I'm a veteran of the Vietnam era, you know, and I actually volunteered to go to a war that there were a whole bunch of people that were backing away from and were either afraid to go or didn't want to go and had their own races. But I'm kind of wondering whether my vote, I'm not capable of donating $100 million to anybody, whether my vote is valuable as their vote, because I thought it was supposed to be. Your guest also said that he's surprised that more people, he doesn't think there's that much money into politics, and he's afraid that, he's not afraid, but he wonders why there isn't more. To me, that's kind of a, I wonder why there isn't less. I wonder why we can't do something about people buying our elections, because I think my vote's important. Mm. But I know it's not worth $100 million.
Daniel.
Yeah, a couple good points your caller raises. I think first is the way we think about campaign finance. It's, we often think that large donors, in the, your caller's example, casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, are saying, well, I'll give you the money, candidates, for election, if you support my set of ideas. And then when once elected, enact those into law. But in fact, the process often works the other way around. That is, the candidates actually, are serious people, and they have their own ideas. And it so happens that certain people in society agree with them. And it's often the case that money seeks out people that it agrees with. That the people, so you can find, very wealthy Republican donors like Sheldon Adelson. You can find very wealthy donors like George Soros, who give overwhelmed, or Peter Lewis, the insurance magnate, who give to Democrats. And that's because they tend to agree more with Democrats. So in part, the money is following the candidates that they believe, and oftentimes the money, especially from corporations, tends to go to candidates they think is going to win in hopes of later gaining access to the candidates after election. So partly it's a little bit the other way around. And I only meant in my earlier comments to suggest that, partly running a sophisticated campaign that's going to inform voters about candidates and their positions on complex policy issues in today's world is expensive. Modern media markets and media time is very expensive, and that's partly what's going to drive up the cost of these campaigns.
There is something kind of weird, though, because nobody's going to be knocking on Pat's door and ask about his experience in Vietnam and really, court his voter. People like him, but they're sure going to go to George Soros or Sheldon Adelson. There's something inherently kind of messy about that, isn't there?
Well, I actually disagree. I mean, maybe no one has gone to Pat's door, but if you're in a swing state, in a competitive presidential election, all you need to do to get, former presidents to call you is declare yourself an independent who's undecided.
You have a point
with
that.
They do.
And you'll have
many people coming to visit you. the issue is, in fact, our modern political parties are very sophisticated at figuring out who voters are. Both parties keep extensive databases that use consumer data to find out who Americans are. They sample, use lots of polling data to find out, all the demographic characteristics of people who live in different parts of the countries, how many veterans live in a certain area,
right.
The job profile, income profile. So they may have, Mr. Adelson and Mr. Soros and others may have a lot of money, but they still only have one vote at the end of the day. And you've got to use that money to try to win the votes of people like your caller.
Daniel, thank you very much. We never got to education, but we will sometime. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Daniel DeSalvo, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership. Pat, thank you very much for your call. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee, where it looked like it was midnight an hour ago, but now it's a little brighter. We'll be back.